Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. I'm Jason.
And I'm Mark.
And we are your hosts on this journey, this very long journey. It is New Year's Day, 2024. It is the fourth calendar year that Doctor Who Literature has been an ongoing podcast. And Mark, I have some exciting news for you.
Go on.
As of today, I am deleting my Twitter account and I am no longer a member of the Twitter platform, and this is probably the best decision that I've ever made. This is just a bridge too far, to quote Operation Market Garden. So, for the first time ever, you will not be able to find Doctor Who Literature on Twitter. But Mark, that does not mean I'm going away.
No, where can we still find you?
I am now on YouTube at Doctor Who Novels. So it's YouTube/@DrWhoNovels. It is the same as my old Twitter handle, but I have put the entirety of the podcast, which is currently 116 episodes, not counting this one, and they are all up on YouTube. They can be streamed and liked and shared and commented upon. Very exciting times for Doctor Who Literature. But Mark, I hate to disappoint you, but you will not be seeing live video on YouTube. You will not be seeing my face that would break camera lenses, so it would be physically impossible for me to record as a video. But the audio podcasts are all up on YouTube, and I invite you to join. Any plans to put Trap One on YouTube?
No plans at the moment, no, but maybe it's something we should look into to appeal to the younger generation.
Well, the younger generation, they want live video, they want graphic effects. I will not be doing that, at least for the indefinite time being. But it is there on YouTube if you would like it. And I am also on Blue Sky at Dr. Who Novels, the exact same username. If you are a longtime fan of the show and you would like an access code, I still have a few Blue Sky access codes to give away. Just email the pod at Dr. Who Literature. That's drwholiterature@gmail.com. And Mark, of course, I have you to thank for my original Blue Sky access code.
You're very welcome. I also have about 10 spare codes, so if all yours go, Jason, send it in my direction, or I can send them on to Jason to share by email as well.
So, talking about Doctor Who as an ongoing TV concern, this is the first time since Chris Chibnall went away as showrunner that we do not have a New Year's Day special. The last one was Eve of the Daleks. Chris Chibnall did three New Year's Day specials, I believe. But before that, it was Christmas specials. When was the very first Doctor Who Christmas special?
Well, it depends if you count a special as an episode that is a standalone episode just to be released on Christmas Day, or whether it's part of an ongoing serial. But I suppose a lot of people would say the Feast of Stephen as part of the Daleks Master Plan. Because although it's part of the wider Daleks Master Plan, it's so inconsequential. I understand it was not included in some overseas sales and is generally just a bit of a runaround comedy episode.
It's a very interesting story. And the original plan was for us to watch it live and do a commentary for Xmas, but you and I were not available. But it does not have any Daleks in it. I think they are mentioned once as a continuity link to the previous week, but they are not in it. It has two segments set on Earth. The first half takes place in a police station in London. I think the original plan was to use the cast of Zed Cars as the police officers, but that never went off until you read the John Peel novelization, in which all the policemen are named for the actors who were on Zed Cars, including Brian Blessed. The second half takes place in Hollywood in the 1920s, in the silent film era, and it's the one forgotten celebrity Doctor Who historical, because one of the characters that the Doctor meets is Bing Crosby, a very historically inaccurate Bing Crosby, but it is meant to be a comedy. Terry Nation got his start as a comedy writer before he fell into science fiction. So each half is comedic. There is some breaking of the fourth wall. Not just the Doctor turning to the camera at the end, but the Doctor also recognizes an actor who had been in the Crusade a year earlier and says, "Didn't I see you in the marketplace at Joppa?"
Yeah.
So that's sort of fourth wall breaking. It is very funny, but you have to be in the right mood for it because it is a very dated style of comedy. But you knew that there was this one-off Christmas special in the middle of Dalek's Master Plan. What you might not know is that the following episode, Episode 8, Volcano, is a New Year's Day special. It was airing on New Year's Day, so there are Daleks in it, and it does sort of ramp up the plot. But it is also a lighthearted comedy episode with a New Year's Day montage at the – or a New Year's Eve, I should say, montage at the end. So although Resolution is the first billed as New Year's Day special, I would argue that Volcano was the first proper New Year's Day special in Doctor Who. So, Mark, guess what?
What?
You and I are going to watch it right now and do a live impromptu audio commentary for Dalek's Master Plan Episode 8, Volcano, the New Year's Day special, and a special Doctor Who literature episode aired on New Year's Day.
Fantastic.
Or as I always say, let's get to it.
Hello, fellow time travelers, and welcome to the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, the only podcast to discuss, in story order, all the Doctor Who novelizations. My name is Tony Whitt, and every 2 weeks or so, I'm joined by a 2-to-3-person discussion panel, including our so-called expert who's been a Who fan since 1979. That would be me. We also get the views of intermediate, casual, and novice fans who either have never seen the show or who have never read these books until these podcasts, including
Dalton Hughes
and
Allison Fitz-Seyfried.
You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find good podcasts, or even ones like ours. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Enjoy your travels.
Alright, so we'll start the episode at the count of 3, 2, 1, play. So, on a scale of 1 to 10, Mark, how energized are you by watching the William Hartnell opening title sequence?
Yeah, I like them a lot. They're quite alien, aren't they? I can imagine in 1963 in particular, you've seen nothing else like that. That howl around effect that they decided to employ for this, having discovered that pointing a camera at its own monitor creates that effect. The music is eerie and alien. I think you still get that sense even now that you're watching something exciting and strange from it.
And the first scene takes place in the Dalek's base on Kemble, and you actually see the same howl-around effect on the Dalek monitor. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a conscious choice by Douglas Camfield, but as soon as the opening titles end, the first thing you see is the opening titles playing on a monitor in the Dalek computer room.
You see that? Don't you see it in the chase as well, I think, from memory? Do they have that playing? I might be missing
it. I don't know if it segues directly in from the opening credits, but I know it's visible in the background.
Yeah, they use the effect in the Dalek screens as well, don't they?
One thing I regret, when I had Paul Hayes on Doctor Who Literature a couple of months ago to discuss his book, Pull to Open, about the creation of the show, he goes into great detail about the origin of the Howl Around sequence and which BBC production used the Howl Around sequence first, which is how the Doctor Who team discovered it. But I didn't ask him why it says Dr. Oho instead of Doctor Who as they're forming the words out of the howl around. That is, for me, the oldest unanswered question in Doctor Who. Why does it say Dr. Oho?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a strange reflection, isn't it, of that. Yeah, that's a strange one.
One of the things that I love about Dalek's Master Plan are the alien species are so bonkers. I'm watching this via the loose cannon reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And this guy who has tentacles growing out of his face and the guy who's covered in rocks. I mean, I imagine you might have seen similar sights in B-movies, but you don't see aliens this bonkers looking in Doctor Who, typically.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it, to have so many different designs. And they're almost just thrown away because there's so many delegates on Kemble that none of them get much of a chance to shine, or to, you don't learn too much about their civilizations or their planets or anything like that. But any one of them could have appeared, you know, like the Sensorites in their own story, where they are the aliens that the Doctor faces. And of course, we never see any of them ever again, do we?
And it's hard to track which one is which. I know in Running Through Corridors by Rob Sherman and Toby Hadoke, I think they pointed out that one of the delegates switches names partway through the story, because one of the delegates in Mission to the Unknown has a different costume entirely and a different look in Dalek's Master Plan. And I think the one who has tentacles growing out of his face in Mission to the Unknown no longer has tentacles growing out of his face in the story proper. So he's shown in the loose canon recount with tentacles, but I think in the actual live video, he wouldn't have had those tentacles anymore.
There's one central is the one that looks like a black Christmas tree. And on Trap One, we've been covering the Big Finish 60th anniversary series, which was called Once and Future. And the first two stories both have references to Central. They go in the Black Archive, Unit's Black Archive, and they have a weapon that's from Central, I think. And then there's another reference to maybe some art from there. And I thought that was a little Easter egg, that Central was either going to be the villain behind everything in that story or was going to appear in it. But then there's no more mentions throughout of it, and it's finished now. So it was just a coincidence that two writers separately decided to reference one obscure delegate from Master Plan, rather than it being some kind of kind of Bad Wolf style clue to where the whole story was going.
Well, similarly, in the second most recent new Doctor Who episode that aired at the end of 2023 in Disney Plus here in the States, there was a reference to Mavic Chen in The Giggle, and that was a name that probably had not been spoken on fictional television for almost 60 years. How incredible was it to hear Mavic Chen's name again?
Yeah, that was a nice reference. They ran the full gamut, really, of the series, didn't they, with that? They mentioned, the gods of Ragnarok and various other things. That was cool.
Now, plot-wise, even though this is a New Year's Day festive special, this is a pretty important scene plot-wise. So the Daleks have their Time Destructor, which is how they plan on destroying time and conquering the universe, and it ends up being used to deadly effect in episode 12. But here they discover the Doctor has stolen the Terranium core and given them a fake one. So they try to execute one of the delegates as a test subject, and it doesn't work because the Doctor has stolen the power device to the machine. So they end up just exterminating the delegate anyway, because Daleks never let a good corpse go to waste.
Yes, it's Trantis, isn't it? Here is the delegate that gets exterminated, despite his protestations that he got the Terranium from Uranus, which the Daleks don't find funny, which just shows what emotionless, cold, ruthless machine creatures that they are.
He really pulled that one out of Uranus.
Yeah. Yeah, I like there's some dialogue here which I really like, where they're talking about what must have happened, that the Terranium core's been switched, and they say, oh, it's these humans, and the dialogue about the Doctor merely being disguised as a human but being a creature from a completely different galaxy. I really like that take on it, that aliens consider him disguised as a human, not that Time Lords look like humans or anything like that, but that he's disguised as one. And I suppose it ties into fact that despite being an alien, the Doctor dresses like a human. You know, he doesn't wear, you know, kind of anything futuristic. He wears sort of period, for, you know, for a lot of his incarnations, sort of period Earth costumes. And I thought that was just a different take that you don't really hear mentioned very much on Doctor Who.
What's interesting is this episode 8, was written by Dennis Spooner, not Terry Nation. Terry Nation's last contribution to Dalek's Master Plan as a script would have been the Christmas special. So 8 through 12, they may have been co-plotted by Nation, but they were written by Dennis Spooner. So that may have been his pet theory, because remember, at this time in the show's history, we still don't know who the Doctor is. There was the reference in the pilot, probably written by Bunny Weber, that the Doctor was from the 49th century, and that, of course, was deleted when they reshot the pilot as the proper unearthly child. So nobody at this point knew who the Doctor was or where he was from. This may have been Dennis Spooner on his way out the door trying to put in his pet theory, but of course nobody else ever picked up on it.
Yeah. And Dennis Spooner introduced the meddling monk in the Time Meddler, who we may see again shortly.
Spoilers! So the chase had worked so well that the middle portion of Dalek's master plan is basically a sequel to the chase, but now instead of the Daleks chasing the Doctor, it's the Daleks chasing the meddling monk chasing the Doctor. So in this scene here, the Doctor and Stephen and Sarah Kingdom are looking at the, I think in the chase it was called the Mean Free Path Tracker, and they see they're being followed by another time machine. So the Doctor automatically assumes it's the Daleks because he just left them behind, and this just happened in the chase a year ago. But of course, as we find out, it is not the Daleks. It is a different returning villain who is also trying to get revenge on the Doctor.
Yeah, it's at the time curve indicator here, isn't it?
Oh, time curve indicator, right. Before we talk about Sarah Kingdom, Loose Cannon is showing us an actual live footage from a cricket test match. This scene ended up being hugely influential on a young member of the audience who would have been watching it probably at 13 or 14 years of age. Do you know who that young audience member was?
I think you're probably referring to Douglas Adams, who would write something similar later on in his career. And then in terms of Doctor Who, it was then adapted back into The Cricket Men, wasn't it? With some very similar scenes to what he'd used for... It's Dirk Gently, isn't it? I think that he...
I think it was Life, the Universe, and Everything, which is the third Hitchhiker's book, which I have not read since the 1980s.
Okay. Yeah.
But that was basically adapted from The Cricket Men, and it had this scene, lock, stock, and barrel, almost word for word.
Yeah.
So yeah, when The Cricket Men is Life, the Universe, and Everything, but restored back to Doctor Who with The Doctor and Romana, written by James Goss. So yeah, I think this scene has appeared multiple times throughout history, but this is the origin.
Yeah. And it's cricket itself, an ancestor of baseball, which is a common theme on Doctor Who literature.
Baseball is probably the secondary theme of the podcast, yes.
And it's interesting, you're watching this, you know, from being familiar with 60 years of Doctor Who. The Doctor at this stage doesn't recognize a cricket match. And also later on in the episode doesn't recognize New Year's Eve celebrations. So at this point, he's very unfamiliar with modern day Earth, isn't he? He's only really spent that time in 1963 when the TARDIS is parked in the junkyard. But he's familiar with different points of history, but cricket, he says, I think it's some kind of a sporting match, but he doesn't know what it is. And then he thinks the New Year's Eve celebrations are like the relief of Mafeking. So he kind of doesn't know that at all, which, you know, I suppose you could headcanon it that he learns all this during his exile as the third Doctor, to the extent that he has cricket outfits aboard the TARDIS for the fifth Doctor to find in Castrovalva.
And not just a cricket outfit, but it's a whole cricket clubhouse. It's almost as if he's copied a piece of a stadium and put it inside the TARDIS, complete with costume.
Yeah, a bit of block transfer computation. Yeah.
We can thank Adric for, I guess Adric must have been a cricket fan growing up on Alzarius.
Yeah. But yeah, interesting how far the character came quite quickly in those early days, isn't it? He's no clue what's going on in a cricket match at all.
And now we have the second appearance of the Dalek time machine, which I understand that some fans have taken to calling the DARDIS, TARDIS with a D for Dalek, although I would never call it that in a million billion years.
Yeah, it's never referred to that. It never referred to as such, is it, on screen, I don't think.
That's kind of a fandom invention, and I can see where it comes from. And now we are getting, at least on Loose Cannon, we are getting recycled volcano footage that was previously seen in Enemy of the World and The Dominators. And then later on will be the backdrop of the opening credit title sequence for all 7 episodes of Inferno. So that's very familiar stock footage for Doctor Who fans in Loose Cannon. I don't know if that same stock footage was used in the original episode as broadcast live on January 1st, 1966. but it's easy to see why the Loose Cannon guys chose to use it.
According to The Complete History, Volume 6, BBC stock BBC film augmented the model volcano footage. The Tiger set itself used back projection of the model volcano behind the TARDIS, plus polyurethane foam for the lava flows and pumped dry ice for geysers. A pipe broke at one point, sending a shot of steam up beneath Butterworth's Monk's Habit.
Oh, wow.
There's potentially an outtake that could have been quite funny there.
It's funny because I was just listening to your Trap One interview with Barnaby and Sophie Aldred about the audio spinoff from Greatest Show in the Galaxy, and Sophie was telling the story about how Sylvester McCoy was caught off guard by the ferocity of the explosion at the end of Part 4, but just kept walking like an action movie hero. And the thing almost knocked him over, but he refused to fall down and just kept moving.
Yeah.
I wonder if Peter Butterworth had the same composure.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one thing, because Sophie says in the interview that Sylvester thought his back was on fire, or the back of his costume was on fire as he walked away, but he kept walking. But yeah, being shot directly up your monk's costume would be more uncomfortable potentially. Yeah.
It depends whether or not he was wearing shorts underneath the costume.
Yeah.
So how did you come to get Sophie Aldred on Trap One? That is like the greatest coup in the history of Trap One.
Yeah, he's absolutely unbelievable. My 8-year-old self would just his head would explode. So yeah, as you mentioned, there's an audio sequel by AUK Media to The Great Show in the Galaxy, which is called Children of the Circus, and Barnaby Eaton Jones is the director of it, and it stars Sophie Aldred, but not as Ace. Sylvester McCoy is also in it, but not as the Doctor. So they got the rights, I think, to Stephen Wyatt's characters from The Great Show in the Galaxy, but not the Doctor and Ace who are in there. So you've got the Gods of Ragnarok and Flower Child and Bellboy and quite a lot of the original cast. And it's a musical, and it's quite kind of out there, but it's really entertaining. I'll definitely recommend it. In the process of promoting that, Conrad, who's one of our Trap One co-hosts, has done some work with AUK Media. And approached him about appearing on the podcast to promote it. So I had to really think about it for about 0.1 of a second, and said, yes, I'd love to have Sophie Aldred on the podcast to promote the new play.
Well, I don't know. Let me check my schedule. I'm a little busy. Absolutely.
And she was as lovely as you'd expect. She's so nice, yeah.
Oh, I can absolutely imagine that. She is just completely wonderful. And I was envious of your composure. I would have been asking compound questions and tripping over myself, and you were just very, very calm and collected, and it was very impressive.
I spent all day preparing myself.
So what we have now is the meddling monk is trying to sabotage the TARDIS lock, because that's how the Doctor left him at the end of the Time Meddler. Then they have this very funny conversation from across the studio, complete with echo sound effects. Peter Butterworth had played the monk in Time Meddler, which was shot towards the end of the season 2 production block, and this is the middle of the season 3 production block. He was so funny and such a good guest star that I imagine he was immediately brought back. So he's the second Doctor Who villain brought back for more after the Daleks, and he's the first humanoid villain who's brought back for more. So instead of just being in a one-off story, the monk is in two stories. So he's in a 3-part segment of Dalek Masterplan, episodes 8, 9, and 10, following the Doctor from this planet to the Great Pyramid in ancient Egypt. This makes him kind of a precursor to the Master, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like Peter Butterworth as the monk. I think he's fantastic. And I love the really gentlemanly way that they greet each other, asking after each other's health, and there's no sort of, you know, with the Master it's always sort of, my dear Doctor, you have been naive, and that kind of thing. They greet each other as old friends in a very kind of jocular way, and I really, really like that element of it. Every time I watch Peter Butterworth as well, I think how much he reminds me of Patrick Troughton as the Doctor, and it kind of makes me wonder whether that was, you know, in some way an influence on casting Patrick Troughton as the Doctor.
It's an interesting point, and I believe I may be getting parts of this story wrong. When I had Elizabeth Morton on Doctor Who Literature, she was introduced to Peter Davison, I believe, by Peter Butterworth's child, son.
Yeah, that's a lovely story.
And here they are enjoying the echoes in the studio and laughing very, very silly. This is not the sort of comedy scene you get with the Master. There is this tendency in fandom, I think, to say that, oh, the meddling monk becomes the Master, or the war chief becomes the Master. As far as I'm concerned, they're three separate people, and the show works better that way. I just really enjoy the comic energy that the monk brings. He's not totally a bad guy. He's just got his own mischievous agenda. It is very funny.
Yeah, and if you ever hear Rufus Hound plays the monk on Big Finish, and he's brilliant as well. He's absolutely perfect casting. He'd be great if they did ever bring him back on TV to have Rufus Hound play the part. He's a brilliant successor to Peter Butterworth.
I have not heard the monk on Big Finish. There's a lot of Big Finish that I have not been able to hear. And is it true, I have read this, that the monk at some point regenerates into a female and becomes the nun?
Yeah, I think so. I think that might be in a David Tennant one. I'm not sure. It's hard to sort of keep track of even the ones I've heard. That I've heard such a volume of them over the years. I think that does ring a bell, though. Maybe it's Dalek Universe. Yeah.
So while the Daleks were in the beginning of this story and want to chase the Doctor to get the Terranium Core back, the rest of the episode is given over to the Doctor and the monk's comedic reunion as they try and one-up each other. So that, again, lends towards the lighter tone of the story. And you made the point earlier, yes, they made the deliberate decision not to market Feast of Stephen because it wasn't part of the story. So it was done... It was released, but it was never kinescoped, as far as I understand. I think the actor who played Bing Crosby may have taped it off his television, but I don't believe that an actual kinescope ever existed or was sold, right, if I'm recalling from the book Wiped correctly.
Yeah, and I'm sure I've read articles that say it's the most lost story, in the sense, because it was never sold overseas, it's the least likely ever to be returned. I suppose as time goes by, it's been 10 years since the last recovery, you know, the chances are decreasing all the time, but the chances of the Feast of Stephen being recovered are the most vanishingly small of all.
Dalek's Master Plan 2, Day of Armageddon, was discovered about 20 years ago, although as fast as I'm aging, it feels like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But I would love to get the rest of this story back. I mean, I love the 12-part Dalek's Master Plan. People will say, as fans always do, that it's 2 episodes too long, or in this case, 6 episodes too long. I think it's structured very well, because parts 1 and 2 take place on Kemble. Parts 3 and 4 lead up to the death of Katarina, which is the first time that a companion had been killed. 5 and 6 is sort of a mini-chase, where Sarah Kingdom goes from being the killer of Brett Vian to the Doctor's new ally. 7 and 8 are the Christmas and New Year specials, respectively. 9 and 10 is the 2-part Ancient Egypt serial with the monk and the Daleks. And then episodes 11 and 12 is the shattering 2-part conclusion on Kemble, resulting in Sarah Kingdom being killed. If you watch it as 6 2-part stories, I think it's perfectly constructed. And in fact, it's very similar to the structure of Flux, which as a 6-hour episode is the same length as Dalek's Master Plan.
That's true. Yeah, that's a great point.
Although I think Dalek's Master Plan has a stronger finish than Flux did, but Flux was supposed to be 11 hours, and because of the pandemic, they had to cut it down to 6. Yeah. So some plot threads were sped up or lost in translation.
So yeah, there's the New Year's Eve celebrations at the TARDIS Witnesses. So yeah, again, the Doctor not kind of recognizing that suggests, I suppose, that he either wasn't on Earth originally during a New Year's Eve celebration, or he never interested himself in that at all, and just stayed in the TARDIS trying to fix it with Susan.
Yeah, the Hartnell Doctor was not really the partying type. He was not really the kind of Doctor who would, you know, put on a party hat and a kazoo and stand in Times Square for 9 hours waiting for the ball to drop at midnight.
Yeah,
this is Trafalgar Square, I believe, and I have been there, but never during New Year's Eve.
Yeah, I think that's right, and no, I haven't either.
Have you ever physically climbed up onto the base of Nelson's Column? My kid can do it, but with my metal elbow, I don't have the ability to climb up on top anymore.
I haven't. I don't know if I've ever been to Trafalgar Square.
I've been there and you haven't? That's pretty impressive. I've been there twice.
I've spent very little time in London, generally, because where I live in the north, I'm much closer to Edinburgh, so I've spent much more time in Edinburgh than London in my lifetime.
All right, so while New Year's is counting down, let's talk about Sarah Kingdom. Is she or is she not a proper companion?
I think she is. Yeah, I think the fact that she's traveled in the TARDIS to numerous locations makes her a companion.
And John Peel, of course, deliberately wrote a prologue to the second Daleks Master Plan novelization, The Mutation of Time, which is the novelization of episodes 7 through 12, but he has a scene in the beginning, late at night on the TARDIS, where Sarah can't sleep. Then it turns out she's been on board for several months, and that left room for other folks to write Dr. Stephen Sarah stories. Big Finish later picked it up by having Gene Marsh do some stories, although that took place later on, not during that interregnum. Mm-hmm. But the idea of having Gene Marsh as a companion is a tremendous selling point for the show. So even my understanding is she was pitched as a companion, and they wanted her to be a companion, but she couldn't commit more than 8 weeks. So they ended up just using her in the one story and killing her off. So some folks argue that she is not a companion for that reason, because she declined a longer contract. But it's for the same reason that people call Kim Basinger a James Bond girl, even though the movie that she was in is not part of the Eon canon. People will contort the canon in order to include her as a Bond girl. So for the same reason, I think it works better if you have Jean Marsh as a Doctor Who companion, even if she isn't.
Yeah, and in Day of the Doctor, we do see in the Black Archive, we see that board, which is full of photographs of different companions, and we see Sarah Kingdom meeting Mike Yates.
That's right.
So canon on screen, we do know that there are other adventures in there as well.
And we should point out that Richard Franklin passed away a few days ago as we record this.
Yeah, that's really sad. He's one of the Doctor actors I never got to meet.
I met him at L.I. Who in November 2016. That was the only time that I've seen him live. And I understand he fell into ill health and retired a couple of years ago during the pandemic. So I was following him along on Twitter. And it's unfortunate that we've lost him now. Are there plans to do a Trap One commemoration special for Richard Franklin and his time on Doctor Who?
No, that's not something we've talked about. But yeah, something to think about, I think. Our Trap One colleagues went to one of the Devil's End days in the, I can't remember the name of the village where the Demons was filmed, but they do events down there. I think
is
it
that
was
Aldborn?
Yes, that's right, yeah. And I think it was Conrad's first Trap One as host about the day. And he got Richard Franklin to record the introduction to that episode of Trap One. So he was very kind to do that. So it has appeared on the podcast in a nice little introduction. So yeah, you can find that in the Trap One back catalogue.
Oh, wow. I'll try and put a link to that in the show notes for this episode. That's amazing. I don't think I actually remember that. So I'll have to go back and give that a listen.
It's a good few years ago now. It's before the pandemic.
Sorry, say that again?
It's a good few years ago. It's pre-pandemic.
And you also have done a lot of Trap One episodes about the Paul Mars Nest Cottage audios, which featured Mike Yates as Tom Baker's companion. So he had this long contribution to Doctor Who even afterwards.
Yeah, I love those stories. Yeah, there's three series of that, which we covered over the last couple of years when the stories have all been released on vinyl. These absolutely beautiful vinyl sets that they're eye-wateringly expensive, but they the artwork and the boxes and the booklets and things that come with them look absolutely absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, we covered those stories then, and Mike Yates works really, an older Mike Yates, sort of semi-retired, works really well with Tom Baker's Fourth Doctor and the setup of the Doctor's going to Nest Cottage and getting into these adventures with his housekeeper and stuff. Really nice. It was originally going to be Nicholas Courtney, but I think was too ill. So they rewrote them for Richard Franklin as Mike Yates, and I think works just as well.
Mike had been given the first real sustained story arc on Doctor Who, because before then you would have recurring characters like the Monk or Professor Travers. But, and this is just a sign of Barry Letts and Terrence Dix's genius, in the 90s, when arc television became a thing, and every show had an ongoing arc and characters would change and evolve and go from good to bad or bad to good, Mike Yates was doing that on Doctor Who in the early 1970s, because between the Green Death, where he is possessed by a boss and has a mini breakdown, and Invasion of the Dinosaurs, where it turns out that as part of his breakdown and recovery, he was given time off and became caught up in Operation Golden Age and returns to UNIT as a double agent. And then ending with Planet of the Spiders, where he joins a Buddhist monastery and redeems himself and is shot at the end with mystical spider energy, but his goodness of heart and purity of spirit save his life. And that's kind of his valedictory on Doctor Who, and he's never seen on camera again. But it's pretty groundbreaking that Doctor Who is doing this 90s-style storytelling in 1973 and 1974, and that Mike Yates is the character who is chosen for that purpose. I think it's really wonderful storytelling, and Richard Franklin is skilled enough to pull it off, because he's playing three different versions of Yates across those stories. He's playing the possessed bad guy. He's playing the reluctant bad guy who doesn't want to betray UNIT but believes in the cause. And then, of course, his post-UNIT self in Planet of the Spiders, where he calls up Sarah Jane and tips her off to what's going on and helps save the day in the end. So, you know, all credit to him for doing a great job across that cycle.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a great idea. And one of the few times in Doctor Who that where they have that regular supporting cast that isn't just the Doctor and the Companion, where they can do that, and they can have a character that's been around so long and such an ally that it is a shock when they turn out not to be on the Doctor's side. So it was great that they, quite bold storytelling, like you say, for the time that they did that. And it makes him, I suppose, more memorable character potentially than he would have been otherwise.
And when people recall the John Pertwee Doctor, all they tend to talk about is how rude he was in certain scripts. And there's a lot of fans to this day who don't like John Pertwee because he was scripted as being nasty to a whole run of civil servants or Joe Grant. But if you look at the way that he plays off the revelation, I think in episode 5 of Invasion of the Dinosaurs, when he realizes that Mike is the traitor, this would be very easy for an actor to yell or to fulminate, or to, as we would say in America, go for the Emmy. He plays it off as quiet disappointment. And I think that's a really strong actor's choice. And it's part of why John Pertwee is one of my favorite doctors, even after all this time. It's a very clever way of playing the revelation that one of his oldest friends has betrayed him to the bad guys. Just quiet disappointment.
Mm. Yeah, it's very well done. And that it does play into the Nest Cottage audios as well, that history of the character, and he's even his own worries about those vulnerabilities. It's really beautifully written by Paul Maher. So if anyone hasn't heard them, I would strongly recommend them.
So this is, of course, as I mentioned, a new chapter for Doctor Who literature. We are no longer on Twitter. Although folks are free to post my episodes on Twitter, I will no longer be there to be tagged in or to share. I will be sharing the episodes on your podcatcher of choice and Blue Sky and YouTube. I'm also on Mastodon, but I have not been using Mastodon as much. I find that most of the folks that I'm following from Twitter have all migrated over to Blue Sky. So that might be the new Doctor Who channel of choice. But we're on YouTube as well as your favorite podcatchers. Any big plans in store for Trap One for 2024, Mark?
Yeah, very, very excited to be releasing the episode shortly on the Season 20 Blu-ray box set, which is one that you're on. I've been editing that over the last few days. It's a really fun episode, really interesting points about all those stories. And, you know, I think what is the biggest collection so far in terms of material. So that's great. We'll be finishing off our coverage of Once and Future, Big Finish's 60th anniversary series, which I mentioned. We've got a really nice episode with Mark Doddick, which is about one of the 60th anniversary decades novels. The first one of those, which is set in the 60s and is by Jacqueline.
Jack Rayner.
Jack Rayner, that's it. So my mind just went back there, yeah. I can do that again.
I am in that episode too, by the way.
Yes, that's it, yeah. That was a really lovely story, and we had a great time discussing that with you as well. So yeah, lots of good stuff coming up on Trap One in the new year.
As well as our long-awaited episode on the Church of Ruby Road, which I am finishing recording today with our last two panelists, and that episode should be going out fairly soon as well.
Fantastic.
So I've been on a lot of Trap Ones lately. I'm sure you're getting sick of me.
Not at all. Not at all. Never. That'll never happen. We'll be recording most excitingly a Trap One field report from Gallifrey One in a few weeks. Should be my first time in attendance at that convention.
And this is possibly the biggest guest list ever at Galley One, because you were going to have Billy Piper. You're going to have Camille Kaduri. You're going to have Matthew Waterhouse. You're going to have Lala Ward. You're going to have Eric Sayward. You're going to have three different guests from Big Finish. You're going to have your usual incredible run of Big Finish artists and writers. And you're going to have Derek Jacobi is going to be at Galley One in 6 weeks. And you are going to be there for it.
Yeah, I've got his autobiography and I've had it on the shelf for a few months and not read it yet. So one of my New Year's resolutions is to read his autobiography before flying to LA in February.
In Doctor Who literature terms, Derek Jacobi was also the audiobook narrator for the Target adaptation of The Mind Robber, which is coming up episode 114 of this podcast, probably about 4 or 5 months out. And Derek Jacobi read the audiobook and does a terrific job with it. Having Derek Jacobi as your audiobook narrator is always a good idea. And the fact that he did a Doctor Who shortly after his time on the show in Utopia and before he became the War Master in Big Finish, it's just awesome that they were able to get him. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I love his War Master stories on Big Finish as well. They're always really good.
One of the great things about Gallifrey is that you have a lot of extra opportunities to meet the guests. The big guests are all on the main stage, and that is a room that fits, 3,500 people. So you can be sitting very far back and seeing Derek Jacobi the size of a lima bean. But you also have the opportunity for autographs and photo sessions where you stand with the actor. And they are doing script readings for Lala Ward and Matthew Waterhouse and Derek Jacobi. So for some extra money, you pay to be in a small group and you're given a script that he was in and he reads it out with members of the audience. So it's your chance to co-star with Derek Jacobi or Matthew Waterhouse or Lala Ward. I have paid for two of those three. So hopefully you'll be there right alongside me for at least one of them.
Cool. Yeah, sounds great.
I have done that with Mandip Gill a couple of galleys ago. I got to play a Dalek and exterminate her. And then I was there for the Jodie Whittaker script reading last year, although I was not selected to act on stage alongside Jodie Whittaker, but I was in the room for that. And I have an autographed copy of the Power of the Doctor script signed by her with a heart. And then I got Chris Chibnall, who was there last year, to sign it as well. That's one of my prized Doctor Who possessions.
Brilliant. No, I can't wait.
So yeah, I will be seeing you. It'll be the second time that I'm seeing you in person, both times in the U.S., first in New York, and then in Los Angeles about 6 weeks from now. And you and I will do a live field report from Galley One, from the LAX Marriott Hotel.
Brilliant. I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it, to both seeing you and the convention.
Well, thank you for joining us on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Stangster. And special thanks, I'm going to say that again. Stangster, jeez. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Mark from Trap One. Mark, where can we find you?
I'm still on Twitter at the moment, but increasingly I don't really read it because it's just sort of makes you depressed or angry. But yeah, I'm still Quark McMalus on there, and I'm the same on Blue Sky, which is the main place where now I'll post anything or read anything.
This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and Mastodon, but not Twitter, at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's Dr. Who Literature at gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening. Mark, say it along with me. Whatever you do,
keep
turning the pages.
The pages.
Oh, that was terrible. All right. Well, we'll try it again at Galley in 6 weeks. Mark, have a great night. Happy New Year.
Definitely. Happy New Year. Great to see you.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.